Adelaide himself had been introduced as the man with whom every woman in the world would like to have lunch. Well, actually, a great many of them were having lunch with him today. He's one of the most likable human beings I know. He introduced me and had a great many very kind things to say about me. And then came the dreaded moment when I had to stand on my feet and say what I'd come to say. For once, when I finished, I had that rare feeling that I had done as well as I was capable of doing. Having lived those years with the Roosevelt regime, I felt like talking about them. One of the parts of the speech I liked best was when I described a day in 1939 when Mrs. Roosevelt came to a benefit luncheon my 75th Congress Club gave to buy a wheelchair for a crippled boy. Only one person would benefit, but where else do you start except with one person? And Mrs. Roosevelt was always ready to start, and one person was important to her. A more important line was the one about sometimes silence is the greatest sin. All of us are familiar with people who are the partisans of departed virtue, but are afraid to defend an unpopular truth today. Mrs. Roosevelt never stood with this timid company. She was never afraid to speak up against wrong, no matter how many brickbats it brought down on her head. Sometimes I think somebody ought to give an accolade to her generous and understanding husband, who took those brickbats too and recognized her for the good she was. My simpatico feeling for the subject and the 2 hours I spent with Mrs. Provenson learning how to say what I thought paid off, and when I finished and walked down star-studded table, I felt like I had acquitted myself well, something I seldom feel. After the heady hours of seeing New York's assembled great, I spent the next hour or so in relatively minor household errands, trying to find some fabrics for the third floor solarium and some things for Linda's room. Bid goodbye to Jean Kettner, whom I thought ought to go home and take a couple of relaxing pills and put her feet up for the next week or so, and then caught the 6:30 plane back to Washington. All day there had lain in the back of my mind the dismal gray fog of what Lennon had said about a national railroad strike. And when I reached the White House, I found that he was still at his office, that he had taken the bold stroke of asking the railroad brotherhoods and the leaders of the railroads to gather with him and lay out some plans to mediate their difficulties, which has been festering over 4 years. How presumptuous that thinking you could walk in on a sore that had been gathering venom for that long, that you could do anything to lance and heal it. But he's not a man to let it burst in front of him without having a try. So he didn't come home to let me tell him what a good time I'd had in New York. He stayed at his office, or maybe it was the EOB, until midnight, working with them. I had a bite on a tray and went to bed, leaving him for a late midnight bite. That's been twice this week. One night the farm bill, tonight the railroad strike threat.